there's something from everywhere today. Maybe I know what they is. Some things I share from my mind. Seeing things in a different way. Don't care if God thinks it's his. Corporate media is spreading lies. If we keep killing our planet for resources in our skin, then mister, you're about to die. Tell you what I think about a situation. Decentralization, exhilarating, cooperation is important, you see? If the television tells you that the money matters, since you know it ain't, stop spending, grow again. I know you can, my friend. If someone tells you that they need a favor, even if you think you can't, you should still try helping others again. I bet you'll make new friends. Again and again and again and again. There's so many things right in the world today. We can all help right the wrongs. So go tell them you know. Give this podcast a go. And we'll all keep things wrong. Stepping off the edge. You can help your friends start learning. Stepping off the edge, you can arm yourself with knowledge. Stepping off the edge, they can't stop social barriers from falling. Stepping off the edge. Stepping off the edge.
Hello, and thank you for stepping off the edge. This is episode 3, The Philosophy of Open Source. It features an interview I recorded with Matt Mullenweg, a technological optimist and lead developer of WordPress. WordPress is one of the dominant content management systems and blogging platforms available on the internet today. The best part of the platform is that it's entirely open source, 100% free to download, install, and use. For those who have never tried WordPress, it offers an easy publishing process, yet can scale to meet almost any website situation you can think of. I often describe WordPress as having an open, extensible architecture that allows you to upload or code plugins, which modify how your site behaves, or themes, which modify how it looks. You can modify almost any part of a WordPress site to suit your needs, and not have to worry that it will break when the next release comes. The self-hosted version is my platform of choice, including for the Steppin' Off the Edge website and podcast. One free plugin handles the heavy lifting of integration with iTunes. If you want to host your own site, head over to WordPress.org, where you can download the latest version, which comes with a world-famous 5-minute install guide. It is that easy. If you're one who prefers to have someone else take care of the server stuff, head over to WordPress.com. You can sign up for a site, and Matt's company, Automatic, will take care of the complex computer stuff for you. It's kind of like the difference between renting versus buying a house. The house is identical, but there's a different set of costs or complexity involved depending on what you need. For those who aren't familiar with WordPress but want to learn, I'll post a few links in the show notes to help you on your way. In the interview, Matt touches on a few things which I hope will be common narratives as the episode count climbs on this podcast. Things like companies having a philosophy that is about more than money, the competitive value of sharing, level playing field's impact on innovation, and not believing you have to operate using business models of yesteryear. Matt is something of a jazz aficionado, so I've gone with a jazz theme for the music this week. Bookending this episode are two tracks from Cone, Meeting at Mercedes, and Santiago's Passes. In between, you'll hear a remixed version of a Thelonious Monk song, Ruby My Dear, by Melonious Thump, a track from Preston Love's 1969 album Omaha Barbecue, Sam Miller's Groovadelic, and RJD2's soulful song Ghostwriter. For those who are familiar with the WordPress platform, the name Thelonious Monk will probably ring a bell. In addition to each major version release being numbered, it also gets tagged according to a jazz artist of interest. The most recent 3.0 release was tagged with Monk's name, to make the association between his improvisational style of jazz and the new custom post type capabilities, which easily allow WordPress to be modified to capture and display different data types quickly. This is the first episode of the podcast for 2011, and I think it has a pretty good flow. That big red-suited anti-thief Santa brought me a very nice new microphone, and hopefully make my end of the podcast sound that much sweeter. Speaking of Santa, if you're looking for a little creative Christmas conversation, you might want to check out my
podcast pick of the month,
The Extra Environmentalists, Seth and Justin. They recently scored an extra, excellent, extra environmentalist exclusive interview with Nick Claus Jr., the son of Santa Claus. They're in their early days of podcasting just like me. They bring a lot of stories in need of sharing to light from the perspective of two individuals outside the system trying to understand it. You can find them at extraenvironmentalist.com or on Twitter at xenvironmental. If you'd like to share any thoughts about this episode or any other, there are three easy ways to do so. One, visit steppingofftheedge.com, no G on stepping, and use the contact form there. Two, email jamie@steppingofftheedge.com or find me on Twitter at @steppofftheedge. I have had a few humorous questions wondering what's up with the troll-voiced intro music. I'm by no means a singer or musician. Through my use of various technologies, I can make something which closely approximates music, but that's about the best that I can manage. If anybody out there can play guitar, sing, or have anything they think would sound better, I would very much love to hear it, or get in touch with you. I've got a few more comments to follow on the other side of the interview. Until then, enjoy. Mullenweg is a native of Houston, Texas, who loves a good barbecue. In 2004, he dropped out of college, moved to San Francisco to work for the tech company CNET. A year later, he left CNET to found his own company, Automattic, which runs hosted blogging services on WordPress.com and champions the open source community around WordPress.org. With 60 people across 49 cities around the world, the company is truly distributed, or as Matt has characterized it, one that does not support geographic discrimination. Stats now show that WordPress powers up to 10% of websites on the internet.
In 2007, Matt Mullenweg was listed as number 16 on the list of 50 most important people on the web, according to PC World. He was also named by Inc.com as one of America's 30 coolest young entrepreneurs under 30 in 2008. Today, he steps off the edge with me to discuss the history of launching WordPress, the practicalities, possibilities, and philosophy of open source, his dream that the majority of the web can be built to run on open source software, and what his life is like as a benevolent dictator on a platform which some have characterized as the modern day printing press. Matt, thanks for stepping off the edge.
My pleasure.
So let's start to give listeners a little bit of your backstory about the beginning of WordPress. Back in 2003, you were 19, a freshman at University of Houston, and hacking on a web project called B2 or Cafe Log. What is it about this technology that caught your interest?
It was less about the technology and more about the social aspect, where I really loved the idea of blogging. I mean, at its most simplest form, I had become enamored with certain blogs, the idea that these smart people all over the web were sharing their passions and the things they cared about, and you could comment on them. You could have a conversation after every blog post. And so I wanted to do that myself, and I really then and now enjoyed publishing on the web and writing and blogging, and more than anything, the feedback that I get from that.
And so that idea of communication gave you enough confidence to quit your schooling to focus on that?
Not quite. So I began contributing to B2 Cafe Log just like anyone else, helping out on the forums, some very, very small code stuff, because at the time I didn't really know a ton of PHP. And eventually that grew in involvement to where, along with Mike Little, I was actually leading the development of what would be sort of the continuation of B2, which we called WordPress, which is now pretty well known, but at the time had zero users. The first couple of WordPress blogs were just ones I set up for my four or five friends from high school. So, but I knew that, things just felt a little complex to me. I'm a big fan of simplicity. And at the time, for example, to edit the title of your blog, you had to open up a configuration file and sort of manually edit the code just to change the title of your blog. It was actually harder than if you just changed to HTML, harder than a static site. So things like that struck me as just unusually obtuse and things that we could make easier if we just approached it in a slightly different way.
Okay, and those sort of ideas of barriers to communication and trying to reduce those. Now, I read something that when you were looking at different tech companies for jobs and such, you had a personal requirement that you wouldn't want to work anywhere that would prevent you from working on WordPress. How did that affect your recruitment, and why did you end up with CNET as a result of that process in 2004?
Well, I didn't plan to drop out of college. I really had every intention of finishing. But when I visited San Francisco, I also visited Google and all the cool tech companies and CNET and all these different places, and I was quite enamored with it. And so when I returned to Houston, some of them started to follow up. And honestly, I didn't get too far in the process with anyone except for CNET because of exactly what you mentioned. A technology company like Google obviously wants to retain all the intellectual property of their engineers because that's their sort of chief competitive asset. For someone like a CNET, who's a media company, that's not as important. And in fact, they're entirely happy to contribute as much as possible, both back to open source, which lots of companies do, but it also allowed me to retain the intellectual property rights to everything I created, which was pretty unusual. So it was a pretty good fit, and it was one of those things where they made me an offer that was a job that was, something I would dream of if I had finished my last 2 years of school. So it became, I thought, well, why am I waiting?
So was that something you had written into your contract with them about retaining the rights to do that, or it was just sort of more of an informal thing?
Probably, but I don't remember exactly.
Okay. So was that, given that you just described that as a dream job, was it tough to make that decision to quit? And how soon thereafter did you start Automattic?
I ended up leaving CNET and starting Automattic about a year after I joined. And that was a pretty intense year for me. It was a year of some big WordPress releases. For example, that was the release that introduced themes to the WordPress world. They didn't exist before. I learned a ton at CNET. I mean, web publishing kind of got started there because they were one of the first major content producers on the web. So, CMS kind of came from CNET. And also just being in the culture of San Francisco and the Valley, I learned so much in that year. And as WordPress was growing in popularity, it just became obvious to me that there were some things I wanted to pursue that weren't necessarily in line with what CNET wanted to pursue. For example, something like WordPress.com. I had this idea that, WordPress was this software that's starting to gain popularity, but if we can make it sort of one-click easy for people to start using, and sort of experience it, that maybe we could reach a larger audience. And at CNET, they felt a little bit like blogging was a trend on its way out. At the time, there was a lot of negative connotations around the word blog. In fact, no one even liked to call things blog. Everyone tried to call it journals or spaces, or Yahoo called it 360. Everyone was doing blogging, but not calling it that. And also just a lot of questions around the commercial viability of, you know, a blogging site.
And that idea that blogging's been dead has come up numerous times over the years, but it still seems to be kicking.
And I don't think CNET said that blogging was dead ever. They just said that it's not our core business, which is true.
Yep. So let's jump a little bit forward to around 2009. You're rumored to have turned down offers for Automattic in the $200 million range. You're raising lots of money through venture funding. You're acquiring web properties like Gravatar, and becoming an honorary patron to the University Philosophical Society from the Trinity College in Ireland. And you're still just 25 years old. So how does it feel to have such accolades and opportunities when you're really just following your passions at this point?
I don't know. It was a fun year. There's nothing else to say. It was very much a whirlwind. At the same time, Automattic was also really starting to blossom as a company. I think we reached around 35 people then. And that's when, you know, you really get a sense. It's kind of like as many people as you can fit in a room. And it really started to, I'm not really answering your question. What was it?
Sort of the idea that the world is your oyster at that point. Did you feel like it was your Jim Cameron, I'm on the top of the world sort of thing? Or you still like feel like you have more ahead of you to accomplish?
Oh, yeah, not at all. There was, as successful as WordPress has been, I've always been really frustrated with the software. So there's a lot of things that bug me personally about it. So there's never really been a point that we've reached where it felt like we've done or we've reached like this milestone where we can rest on our laurels, because, I mean, both what we need has evolved really fast, what I personally want from the software, and two, the web is moving so quickly. I mean, you know, WordPress started before Facebook did. So we were kind of born into a world without social engagement outside of like Friendster and MySpace. I mean, you know, the web has changed so much since then that the possibilities of what you can do and what you should do and what people want evolves very rapidly. And, you know, to the extent we've been able to maintain and grow over sort of our 8 years of history, it's been how we've remained responsive and in some cases anticipating those major trends.
And I like the notion that WordPress as a platform has tended, from my perspective, to focus a little bit more on the long-term view and what you should do or could do rather than sort of the flavor of the month, which I know in a past interview you had talked a little bit about putting the dig like buttons and those sorts of things onto WordPress.com and some of the challenges or decision-making process that went along with that. So I'm wondering, with Automattic, I'd also read that you have cross-functional teams of 4 to 7 people that mix roles that can do everything on their own, and it's an entirely distributed company. Can you talk a little bit about how Automattic, the company, has grown compared to your expectations and where you see it going in the future?
Sure. So Automattic very much grew out of the open source project. So the first few employees of Automattic, as we call them, automaticians, were completely distributed. I mean, there was Donica in Cork, Ireland. There was Ryan, who I think at the time was in Dallas and then later moved to Petaluma. There was me in San Francisco. I mean, Andy Skelton. I don't remember where he was. Maybe it was New Hampshire or something. I mean, just everyone was all over the world. And so just from the beginning, it made sense to continue that way. And there was never any sort of idea or movement to pack up their life and move to San Francisco, where you're probably going to spend 3 times as much for 1/3 the amount of place to live, and let's all cram into a little office. It was very much, let's keep doing what we were doing because that's worked, and how can we scale that? And what we found first we had to develop some really good online collaboration tools. We used some things that were out there, like for example, IRC, but something that's really evolved for us is actually WordPress. So for example, we use a theme for WordPress called P2. You can get it at P2 theme. That's P as in po' boy. And basically what it is it's kind of like it's a blog, but it's a blog turned upside down. and that to post a post, you don't go to the dashboard. It's just a little box right at the top of the homepage, kind of like Twitter. And when a new comment comes in, you don't have to reload the page. It just sort of shows up on the page, and there's a little notice, like a growl-like notification that says, hey, there's a new comment. And you can go directly to it. And everything's threaded on the homepage, so you don't have to navigate to a permalink to see the conversation around something. That combined with, basically we hooked up all blogs on WordPress.com to Jabber. So every single blog was an XMPP node that you could subscribe to and get instant notifications of any new activity. Kind of transformed the company into this, you know, set of people around these collective hubs of the what essentially was WordPress under the hood, but really felt and worked like something pretty different. Collaborating in sort of a weird mix between real time and asynchronous. So it was real time in the sense that, you know, you get instant notifications of whatever is new. It was very asynchronous in terms that, you know, because we have people all over every time zone, you know, I'll wake up in the morning to, you know, 100 or 150 new messages across the P2s. And I can respond to those, and the conversation is threaded and meaningful. And if someone joins later, like let's say someone new joins a company and starts working on, let's call it VaultPress, through the archives and sort of catch up on everything that's happened with VaultPress over the past year. So that was pretty transformative for us, and it's allowed us to scale to the size we are now, and probably much larger, without, you know, too many, you know, sort of growing pains, because, you know, there's sort of a natural horizontal expansion into more projects, more P2s, more notifications, and also tools like, for example, global search and tags across all our internal blogs that make it very easy to sort of collate and find things.
Do you feel that those tools that you built up, and I like the expression eating your own dog food, where you've sort of taken WordPress and shown the customization potential of it to serve different needs based on what your needs were. Do you feel that that's sort of given you an advantage now in that Automattic hasn't necessarily grown in the traditional vertical approach where you get different layers of managers as much because of the geographic distribution?
Yeah, well, I think the main thing the geographic distribution has given us is just that we're able to hire the very best people in the world no matter where they are in the world. And I see a lot of great companies. You know, I have a lot of friends who run great companies here in San Francisco. And you know, it's not a limited pool of talent. I mean, there's a ton of great people, but it's a fixed area. You're limited to people who already live sort of in the Bay Area or willing to sort of, you know, upend their entire life and move here. And I feel that, you know, that just cuts off such a huge portion of the talented people in the world that it's just a really archaic way of doing things. And it's kind of a factory model. Like, we don't need to do that anymore. We have this thing called the internet and Skype and IRC and WordPress that are really great for communicating and collaborating online. And to the extent Automattic has been successful, it's very much a function of the people, you know, both where they come from and the process through which we hire.
And is a lot of that the case that people who Automattic does hire have had some involvement with WordPress prior to either them applying or you recruiting them, so to speak?
Sometimes, but sometimes not. It's kind of about 50-50. I think that in terms of hiring, what's worked well for us is, one, that we have a philosophy. I mean, we stand for something, you know, other than, you know, the dollar. We have sort of a purpose that's broader than just purely making money. And I think that attracts some of the best and brightest because, you know, at a certain point, you want to work for something bigger in your life. And two, we have an onboarding process that we do two things that are somewhat unique. One is that every person we hire, particularly engineers and happiness engineers, we work with them first. So we hire them on a contract basis, sort of a temporary contract, and we work together, you know, anywhere from 2 to 8 weeks on a part-time basis and see how we work. And there's really nothing I've found, at least, no question you can ask in an interview or no reference you can get that really can substitute for just working side by side with someone, being in the trenches. And so that's worked extraordinarily well for us. Now, it's not a panacea. Like, for example, let's say you're hiring a director of finance, like we're doing right now. It's difficult to do a part-time trial with someone who's going to, you know, run all the finances of the companies. So in those cases, you have to, you know, sort of fall back to more traditional hiring practices. And number two, once we do decide to hire someone, before they do anything else, everyone speaks, no matter what their position is in the company, everyone spends 3 weeks doing support on WordPress.com. So basically on the front lines of, so we offer on WordPress.com, there's a little tab in the top right, and if you click it, basically 24/7, 365, you can get completely free support from a human being. That works for automatic. And it's this is something that's always been sort of a principled thing that we want to provide. But it's also a great way for new folks to both learn a lot about how automatic works on the inside, but two, be in touch with who matters most, which is our users and our customers.
And that CFO role that you're hiring for will start there as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's very interesting. The core philosophy stuff you touched on is actually where I'd like to switch gears now and look more at the concepts of open source and how you've been able to apply them as well as running a successful for-profit company. Maybe for some of the people who aren't familiar with software development, what is open source and why do some people refer to you as a benevolent dictator?
So open source is kind of like a good way to describe it would be like a Wikipedia approach to software. So you have something where if you wanted to, anyone can see sort of what's under the hood of any part of the software. They can open up the code and change any line of it if they want to. Two, that it's community owned. It's not owned by one person, but it's under a license, which allows anyone to modify it or do whatever they please with it. So it's kind of belongs to all of us, not just any one corporation or even foundation or person. So those two things combined tend to engender a lot of community involvement in the creation of the software. So for example, there's a couple hundred people who contribute semi-regularly, pretty regularly, to WordPress development, even though they're not paid by anyone. They don't work for Automattic. They don't work for me. They don't work for anyone else. They just do it because they want to. It's in their spare time. It's something they do for fun. And that, I mean, for very obvious reasons, doesn't really exist in the commercial world. Like, there's no one who walks into Microsoft on a weekend and, like, you know, works on Windows drivers for fun, you know, for no pay or anything. So, but there's lots of open source projects like that. And it typically, they center around things where software that people use themselves. People call me, there's a joke. So open source projects are generally started by one or a small group of people who sort of bootstrap it. And for WordPress, I was one of those people. And so there's a joking rule and role in open source that they call the benevolent dictator, because by virtue of being sort of one of the people who kicked everything off, you sort of have a status in the community, both earned and inherited, where if need be, you can sort of serve as, what's it called in the Senate, where they, if there's a tie, there's a tiebreaker. I forget the name for it.
Not necessarily a referee, but being Canadian, I'm not sure what the specifics of the U.S. side are, but I know where you're going with that, that it's, you're sort of set in a position where you'll try and take a larger view of what the community feels, what the corporate interests are, and not necessarily pick a direction, but try and reach a, bring everybody together to the common direction that you think is in the best interests of both.
Sort of. And it's kind of, it's a funny title because benevolent dictator sounds, you know, quite ominous or powerful. But in fact, it's a completely powerless position because you can't actually tell anyone what to do because everyone's a volunteer essentially. So it's not like you can force anyone to do anything. So to the extent you lead, you do it through the persuasiveness of your ideas in writing and code. And two, because the software is completely open. If someone wanted and they disagreed with anything, any direction of the software, they could take the whole thing and fork it and you know, sort of create their own version of it. So someone could just tomorrow, and they have in the past, take WordPress and, you know, search and replace and make it JamiePress, right? And that's completely allowed and even encouraged under the license and the social mores of open source. So that creates sort of a system of checks and balances, which means that what the project does is really every single time what's in the best interest of the community, because there's really no other logical way to do things.
And the license I know that WordPress runs under is the GPL, or General Public License, and I've heard you describe that as both the most moral of all open source licenses and along the ideas of the Bill of Rights from the U.S. Constitution for the first 10 items from that. Why do you believe so strongly in the GPL in particular?
So, like we said earlier and alluded to earlier, open source means that you can use a software for anything. You can sell it. You can use it to create a site for yourself. You could use it to create a site that I didn't agree with. You could use it to create a site that you know, hates kittens. You could do really anything you like with the software. And it's sort of very much like a freedom of speech. It's one of those things where I may not agree with what you say, but I believe very strongly in your right to say it. Now, the GPL has a twist. So most open source software, you can do anything with it, including taking the software and making it proprietary. So meaning that modifications you make to the software don't transmit the same rights that you yourself received when you got it. And what GPL says is something, has a, just a very clever little twist where it says, if you build something, like let's say you take WordPress and you build something new and better on top of it, when you give that software, let's call it Jamie Press just for the sake of conversation, when you give Jamie Press to your users, you know, 6 months down the line after you've made it into something completely new and awesome, they have to have the same rights. So they have to also be able to use it for any purpose and take the software themselves and change it and do everything. And so it basically ensures that, that's why I think of it like a bill and rights, because there's certain inalienable rights inherent to the software that no one can take away, no matter how they modify it or use it. And I think that's very, very important, because otherwise you get into a situation where you have this thing that's open and great, but anyone can take it and modify it or make improvements, and they're not really, you get sort of a tragedy of the commons where people get a lot of out of this software, but they're not contributing anything back to it. They're not releasing their changes, not sharing their changes. So in the long term, I think that except in more utilitarian or server-oriented cases, that software which doesn't preserve the freedom of its users eventually becomes corrupted or goes away.
And that idea that it stifles the innovation that the community relies on to continue to grow.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's not going to happen 100% of the time. There's great, great projects that will probably outlive me, like Apache, which are under licenses that are not the GPL. But I think particularly with regards to user-facing software, which is a realm which open source is honestly relatively new to, that you can count on, you know, a hand, maybe two, you know, the number of really mass market consumer open source projects. That sort of preservation of rights is really important.
In June of last year, you linked to an article that was titled Web Services as Government, which suggests that web platforms could be thought of as digital governments because they feature a central point of control and create the conditions that encourage others to invest their time and energy to create useful services. And in that, I found the images of Steve Jobs as the king of the Apple monarchy, if you will, and Zuckerberg leading a Facebook Russia, their sort of love for state control power, very humorous. I'm curious what you might define as your nation state or empire from history if you had to pick one for WordPress or Automattic.
I don't know. I'd have to think about that a lot more and probably study a little bit more. But the easy first answer is the United States.
That being the one that was originally founded, not necessarily where they're going today, I would imagine, right?
You know, however you want to slice it. Just the idea that you had a nation that started with what you could term a fork. So a fork from the United Kingdom in terms of the American Revolution. Definitely went through some bumpy parts along the way, but sort of ended up as one of the freest places in the world, in terms, especially with regards to speech and property and ownership rights, and you know the democratic system isn't perfect, but one of the best things out there.
Fair enough. Towards the end of that article, the author Brad Burnham connected some of the ideas you were touching on in terms of freedoms and the idea of data portability, saying that as long as citizens or users can freely move from one government to another with little switching cost, there's no reason to burden these platforms with the inherent inefficiencies of popular democracy. And I know you've had some passions or concepts you've sort of espoused at different WordCamps of the importance of data security and data portability. And do you think that perhaps there's any better ways that that can be done between individuals and web services to balance their needs on that front?
I'm going to expand for a second on your previous question because I thought of one more thing.
Please.
Why I would say WordPress reminds you of America. One of the things I love about North America in general is that I guess we can lump Canada in there. I mean, I enjoy Canada. I go there every summer to Montreal. Is the idea of equality of opportunity, where it's not as important, it's a meritocracy, it's not as important who you are, but it's more what you do. You can have a huge amount of opportunity and the ability to succeed regardless of you know what you've done before and what you've been involved in. To answer your second question, which is data portability, is there anything new there that's really great or a better solution?
Yeah.
The answer is I haven't seen anything yet, so I don't really have too much to talk about there because we're still in a not ideal situation.
No, and it is starting to get better in things like OpenID and with WordPress where you provide importers and exporters to different platforms, but it still seems with a lot of these media platforms, when you sign up, you have to re-add all your friends, or that's their sort of draw, is to get your social network identified in their system. And it'd be curious to see if there's some sort of way where, as an individual, I can maintain ownership of my identity or my social network and provision access to it to the different systems which I want to be the case or not.
I'm not sure if that's actually the most interesting problem to solve, for the same reason that I think OpenID was inherently flawed in that it tried to solve the, you know, users have different usernames and passwords for every single site problem. That's actually not that bad. And as a user, I don't mind that on different services I have different sets of friends because, you know, my social graph, my friendship graph is very contextual. Maybe on a particular site I don't want, you know, my 500 people on Facebook. Maybe I only want the 20 or 30 people who I play Xbox games with. I mean, there's just, you know, there's lots of context and nuance to human relationships that I don't think can be represented by a single site or a single graph.
And it brings that idea when you have a single point of failure in one system, the potential impacts that come from if that one system gets hacked, then everything is exposed rather than at least potentially a subset of it, so to speak.
Sure. So I think probably the more interesting side of that, and probably something that's feasible or becoming more feasible every day, especially now that Facebook provides an export of all your stuff, is just, can I move someplace? Like if I decided I didn't want to use Facebook, is there something else out there that can give me everything that I get from Facebook today? The answer is no, there's not actually. There's nothing that's sort of a drop-in replacement. But, you know, historically, it's not that we necessarily need the thing that's going to beat Facebook isn't going to be something that duplicates all their functionality. It's going to be something with a twist on it, something that's completely different that Facebook either can't do because of their, you know, business or user weight, or something that they won't do because they just feel like it's not what they should be doing. And I don't know what that's going to be yet. But yeah, just historically, we have these sort of big shifts every 5 years or so. Just historically, we have these sort of big shifts every 5 years or so.
And I think one that is starting to come up, which I'd like to explore as the last sort of big topic on this interview, is the idea of a truly open internet. In doing a little bit of research, I found a couple of quotes from you that I'll paraphrase slightly here, which said that technology is closing the gap between what one can imagine and what one can do. And as a result, the equality of opportunity is unmatched in human history. Now, much of that equality is based on the near zero cost of reproducibility, which the internet affords. So a 19-year-old kid from Houston could launch a software service company that does things at a scale for millions of users. But inherent in that is an assumption that the web is or will stay free as a globally accessible environment. In an interview on the Big Omaha conference with Robert Scoble, you said that one of your personal dreams is that the majority of the web runs on open source software. Why is that, and how do you think we could go about building an open internet?
That's a pretty good quote. You should add that to my Wikipedia or WikiQuotes page.
I will. As I said, it's two that I paraphrased together, but in talking with the previous guest, Douglas Rushkoff, about the ideas of the open internet, he said he was very interested to hear what you would have to say in regards to how to go about building an open internet.
So I think first and foremost, well, there's really two sides to it. One, you need open source software running it, simply because at its very core, if there's some layer of the stack, something that you're reliant on, which is less open than anything above it, that becomes the weakest link. And anything that breaks that breaks everything on top of it. So for example, let's say WordPress was reliant on a proprietary database. If that database came out with a new version that said, according to the license, you're not allowed to use this with WordPress anymore, which is completely legal and fine under the way software licenses work, we'd be kind of SOL. So you're only strong as your weakest link in the stack. So I'd say that's the first part. The second part is the quality of access, which you could sort of broadly put under a net neutrality label, but I think touches a lot more than that. So one of the beautiful things about the internet is that you're always one click away from pretty much anything out there. And Google's actually pointed to this as one of the reasons why they're not a monopoly, because they say, you're only ever like one click or a change of homepage away from all of our competitors. It's not like there's any particular lock-in. You're not stuck with us. If you buy a computer, it's not hard-coded to use Google 100% of the time. So that sort of flexibility is inherent. But if, for example, like we're learning more and more about the psychology of speed and how much the speed of a service can both consciously and subconsciously impact our usage of it. So if, for example, because let's say Microsoft buys Comcast and all of a sudden decides to make YouTube and all the Google sites slower and all their sites faster, because unless Google pays a certain amount, which they're not going to pay, very naturally, just whether intentionally or not, people would start to shift their usage. And I'm not sure if that's really fair. I think of the net like an open transit area, like our freeways or something like that, that, you know, we need to keep the ability for anyone to use it as they choose, operating within, of course, the laws of the society and the social mores, but without giving sort of commercial preference to one or the other based on business requirements or anything like that.
Right, and the challenge there in both the highway model and the internet is that both in their current forms are reliant on a certain amount of infrastructure, domain name servers, the routers that sort of pass the packets back and forth. And I think actually Douglas Rushkoff had a recent article that I'll post onto the show notes for the episode, which was more looking at how the idea of a peer-to-peer economy and peer-to-peer networking could perhaps provide something that is a truly open internet. And just from your sense, which is probably much more familiar with the different pieces of the internet hierarchy, how dependent do you feel right now the continued operation of the internet is on centralized control or centralized technologies?
For the foreseeable future. I mean, for the same reason that ultimately, like, this is one area where I think it is useful to have just sort of a set of rules that all the players play by. You can still have commercial entities and lots of money being made and everything, but you still need something that everyone agrees on. For example, telecommunications in terms of phones. Like, I can pick up any phone in the world and dial a set of numbers and reach anyone else, regardless of their providers or where they are in the world or everything like that. But still, somewhere, there's a central registry of how those numbers work and how that number translates into someone's, you know, device or someone's, you know, telephone line. So there is centralization there. And I'm not sure if there's really a true peer-to-peer way to get around it because of, you know, just infrastructure-wise. You know, there's only a certain number of cables going under the Pacific Ocean, and there's, you know, only a certain number of satellites in the sky. I mean, things need to get from one place to another, and they're going to pass through bottlenecks and points of control along the way.
If some of those are open, that, or some of them are sort of the closed source system that has the pay route versus the alternative, if people are comfortable with the speed that the open system has because of the philosophical or moral benefits it gets, maybe that's where we start to see the lines in the sand form, perhaps.
Yeah, and this is not an anti-commercial argument. It's not saying you can't charge for, say, access to your Asia to California Pacific cable, which you invested billions of dollars in building, but just that you charge everyone the same amount. And so you sort of have market forces, which are very democratizing and very very fair in terms of how they treat all players. And this is, by and large, how telecom works in a lot of places. And sometimes small tweaks can have a big impact. Like, it was not that long ago that when you switch providers, like let's say I switched from Verizon to AT&T, I would lose my phone number. And then there was regulation that said, okay, now you have to have number portability. If I switch from one to the other, they have to move my number over. And everyone complained it was going to ruin their businesses, and it was so expensive to implement, but they all did it. And actually, it's pretty good now. Like, I've done it a few times, and it sort of provides me as a user just more freedom and more control over this identification, this, you know, what is it, my phone number. And two, I think also provided more commercial opportunities for all the, both the incumbents and the new entrants, which ultimately translates competition there, translates into a better product for you and me. So it's sort of a win-win-win, just by sort of keeping the playing field level.
I like that concept. From that big Omaha conference, did you stay for or see Gary Vaynerchuk's presentation following yours?
Yeah, I believe I did.
he talked about how people in societies tend to draw lines in the sand and then shortly thereafter go and do those things anyways. So your example of the number portability, he gave the examples of somebody who said they never have a Facebook account or would never get a cell phone, and now those do. And one of the sort of driving concepts I have for this podcast is to highlight the ideas and philosophies of people who those concepts can be sustained across every aspect of life. And your passion for free and open source software and easy content publishing definitely fits that. And I'm wondering, what are some of the lines in the sand, if you put on your sort of big thinking hat, that you think are ready to be erased or should be erased to try and get a sense of where you'd like the society to be in 5 years' time?
Where I would like society to be in 5 years' time.
Obviously, everybody is going to have their own WordPress blog. We can get that one out of the way. Or, sorry, a Jamie Press blog. That's the one I got to go for.
I don't know, because I don't think about... In terms of societies, sometimes I think a lot about, you know, some things we've already talked about. Like, I believe very strongly that this sort of level playing field is important for innovation and the speed of growth of the internet to continue. But at the same time, my personal influence on that is limited and in some ways not important. Like, I can certainly raise awareness of the issue through talking about it, through the, you know, the, what's the word, bandstands, not bandstands, soapboxes provided to me, like this podcast or my blog. But also, I don't worry about it too much because I'm sort of a technological optimist. I feel like in the long term, like, we usually get these things right, especially when they just make so much sense. Like, there's not that many things on the internet that I think are both just completely wrongheaded and I think will remain wrongheaded forever. Like, anything I see as sort of a temporary blip now, even big things like, you know, the foreseeable future of centralization of social technology and social graphs, I think we'll eventually figure out because it's kind of like we know where we're going. It's just a matter of figuring out here to there. And as a whole, both the open source community and just, you know, technologists in general are good at that sort of thing. Where we're not as good at is where we don't know. We know where we kind of know where we need to go, but we have no idea how to get there. And we don't even have 100% of the conviction that we should be there. A better example might be some of the bigger problems our world is facing, like more sustainable energy. That's a really tough problem, and one that there's not. It's not clear that the problem is going to get any easier. And in fact, there's some pretty interesting research that shows that, you know, the cheaper energy becomes, the more of it we use. Pointing to, for example, refrigeration is, you know, whatever it is, 10 times more efficient than it was 30 years ago. But now everyone has like 4 refrigerators and their car is air conditioned and their house is air conditioned and they got a freezer in the basement and all those sorts of things. So even though it's become more efficient, we're not using less energy for refrigeration. We're using a lot more.
Yeah, it's that idea of the ubiquity of technology, the blessing and the curse of more people are going to want those things because of how much better it makes life and the challenges when everybody does have one, so to speak.
Another good example is that we spend more time on the internet the faster it gets. You know, the amount of time you spend on the internet on a dial-up is very different from the amount of time you spend on the internet if you have 100 megabits synchronous connection. And ultimately, we wanted to sort of physical constraints there, like the number of hours in the day. But we have a lot to grow there.
Matt, thank you so much for stepping off the edge with me today. Is there any other comments or thoughts you'd like to share with people out there in internet land as we wrap things up?
No. If you'd like to see more of my thoughts, more of things I'm interested in, you can check out my blog, which is ma.tt. My Twitter is at Photomat, PHOTOMATT. And sort of all the different commercial endeavors I'm involved with, you can see them all on the Automatic homepage. So AUTOMATTIC.com.
Wonderful. Thank you very, very much for stepping off the edge.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for chatting and also for giving so much thought to your questions.
That was Matt Mullenweg, founding developer of WordPress. On his ma.tt website, he describes WordPress as a state-of-the-art semantic personal publishing platform. Another recent guest of this podcast, Douglas Rushkoff, has wrote much about how a previous publishing platform, the printing press, transformed society's ability to communicate at a many-to-many level globally. There were more than a few barriers to entry to using a printing press, not the least of which was time, money, and effort it took to operate. I had one in my basement growing up, and the process of setting letters backwards into trays to print pages one at a time was equal parts art and science. The reality of it is that it wasn't until the arrival of the personal computer that I, like most people, would even attempt to take advantage of such many-to-many communications capabilities. In episode 2, Rushkoff pointed out that the internet has removed many of these barriers to universal participation, and society is now showing an interest in creating and sharing more than passively consuming forms of media that a privileged elite think they should. In my opinion, Matt's interest in the social aspects of blogging and his involvement in building a publishing platform that further reduced these barriers to communication is a step in the right direction. I happened to find a related quote he gave in a profile piece for the Houston Press in 2004 while researching for this interview. Matt said, "I'm a strong believer in blogging, sort of giving people an easy way to let their voices be heard on the web. It's like the pamphleteers of the revolution. It's putting the power of the press into a lot of people's hands, and I don't think we're going to understand the ramifications of the revolution until later." Well, it's a little bit later now, Matt, and I'm still in a reflective mood following the start of a new year. So let me put on my historical prognosticating glasses, which I fully admit do have a little bit of a rose-colored hue to them. 2010 closed out with a lot of focus on the importance of the freedoms and power of the press, with the whole WikiLeaks Cablegate saga. I believe it is probable that history will remember you as something of a modern-day Gutenberg. You'll probably be modest and deflect such praise by suggesting that you had much help in this project, or merely standing on the shoulders of giants like Tim Berners-Lee or Richard Stallman. But Johann Gutenberg didn't invent every element of the printing press either. He merely refined or adapted existing technologies to the purpose of printing. Ultimately, Gutenberg is remembered as one who played a critical role in revolutionizing free and open communications capabilities for all of humanity. I believe that Matt Mullenweg will find a similar place in the digital history books of our culture when all is said and done. One whose efforts are very much a step off the edge in the right direction. Until the next step off the edge, stay happy, healthy, and hopeful.